Gunfight with the Egyptian army in Cairo. Shots and tear gas were fired as the protesters marched on the headquarters of the Republican Guard. The military claims only blank rounds were fired. Our Middle East correspondent Sam Kiley is in Cairo and describes what he saw.
They attempted to clear the area of the crowd using live ammunition and tear gas, very many volleys of both. I saw seven people wounded.
The leaders of the Labour Party and its biggest backer are involved in a war of words. It centres on claims that the Unite Union tried to fix a selection process in Falkirk. Charges could be brought against a police firearms officer. It's after an inquiry found there was no lawful justification for the shooting of a suspected armed robber. 24-year-old Azel Rodney died when the car he was in was stopped by armed police in London in 2005. EU referendum legislation's cleared its first parliamentary hurdle by 304 votes to zero. The bill was introduced by Conservative backbencher James Wharton, saying referendum was long overdue. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
At Creative Common, Bristol. There's live music, festival market, walkabout entertainment, and lots more. Check out jellyrecords.com. That's jelly-records.com.
Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Bristol's Mayor George Ferguson, but unfortunately his staff have sent him over to the wrong radio station, to Ujima, so we'll be joined by George in about 15 minutes. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we've all seen the films, well, many of us have anyway, The Odessa File and The Quiller Memorandum are just two of several feature films dramatising secret SS cults surviving long after World War II. So how real are those films? We examine two compelling and supposedly factual accounts detailing a Nazi financial empire very much alive in the post-war world. Plus, Justice Secretary Chris Grayling wants to cut the legal aid budget, with lawyers given to us by Eddie Stobart and G4S. So we're joined by two lawyers to find out what's been going on at the Justice Select Committee this week up in Westminster, and also here on the ground where the cuts are biting the most vulnerable in our city and legal aid is most needed. Also, eugenics this week. Is it still alive and well and walking our streets in disguise? Jurien Mason is a Dutch writer who believes it is. I spoke to him after his talk at the recent Bilderberg Fringe Festival in Watford. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows down to 13 Celsius, which is rather warm. I think you have to keep the windows open tonight, and dry. This weekend, up to 26 degrees Celsius and pretty consistently sunny. Next week, highs of 23 degrees Celsius, sunny all week. Next weekend, also sunny, mostly. Highs of 23 on the 13th and 14th of July, too. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, whilst we're waiting for George Ferguson, we've got all sorts of questions to put to him about his particular role as mayor of the city, independent mayor. Let's have a chat with Martin Summers. Martin, this week we've had zero-hour contracts being discussed in the news. Yesterday, a big meeting at Westminster about this. This is 300,000 people are on these zero-hour contracts, and that's just in social care. Now, this is as a result, really, of the changes to employment law in this country, and also, of course, a result of the mass pool of unemployed that there's been, really, ever since the 1980s. Tell us a little bit about these zero-hour contracts, because apparently you're signed up for a job, but the employer doesn't actually give you a guarantee of any work at all.
Yes, it just means that they don't have to pay if there's no work for you to do. It's very similar to the sort of contracts people were given in the 19th century, or dockers used to have until the docks labour scheme in the 1960s. You turn up and you hope for work, and if you know, and of course they can pick and choose who they want. I mean, you know, power relations in the labour market in Britain have basically become 19th century.
Previously, the only official estimate of the number of employees on these contracts was a 200,000 figure by the Office for National Statistics based on the Labour Force Survey, which is used to compile the unemployment figures. But Norman Lamb, the care minister, told the Commons in a written reply that 307,000 workers in the care sector in England are employed on such a basis. He said the figures were not collected by the Department for Health, but were obtained by Skills for Care, the Skills Council for the Social Care Sector. There's no breakdown between carers employed by local authorities and privately run care homes or firms. Now, this begs the question, doesn't it, about national statistics? We're told the official statistics that nationally there's 200,000 people on these contracts, but when we look at one specific industry, that's just healthcare, we find that there's 307,000 people. So these statistics aren't worth the paper they're written on.
No, they're not. I mean, unemployment statistics have also become extremely dubious. I mean, Labour Force Survey is an international comparison. So what they do, it's essentially like an opinion poll. They ask a cross-section of people if they are working, and if they're not working, if they've looked for work in the last 3 weeks. And if they have looked for work in the last 3 weeks, they're counted as unemployed. Now, if they haven't looked for work in the last 3 weeks, even if they're on unemployment benefit, they're not counted as unemployed. And of course, the reason why we've moved to Labour Force Survey for measuring unemployment statistics is because the old measure of people who are claiming benefits continuously changes. Because of course, every time you change the regulations, the people who are entitled to claim benefit changes. So you can't compare year on year or generation to generation what the level of unemployment is. But we've become used to a very, very high level of general unemployment in Britain. And of course, it's been used by the bosses to drive down wages and conditions for those in work. Everybody's absolutely terrified of losing their jobs, so they don't make any complaint. And so, that's the purpose of it.
But Martin, why would anyone take a job when there's not actually any guarantee of work?
Because the alternative is not to have any kind of job at all. I mean, what we could be moving towards, and what we should be moving towards, is a citizen's income for all, which means that everybody has a basic income. We're not talking about a king's ransom here, just enough to live on. And then people should be able to take as many hours as they can find on top of that, but with a guaranteed income underpinning the whole thing. And if you were in that situation, you'd have to pay people quite well to do dirty, out-of-hours jobs like social care. And that's all to the good. I mean, people who are looking after the old and the sick should actually be well paid for doing what they're doing. We shouldn't be trying to scrimp on this. If you think about it, it's probably one of the most important jobs that any society does. And to treat it as a kind of zero-hours contract, pay people peanuts, well, that really shows what's wrong with our society, full stop.
Well, the TUC General Secretary, Francis O'Grady, says this rise in zero-hours working is bad for employees and also for service users. Many regular carer or college tutor, something that is severely hindered by zero-hours contracts. Secure employment would allow staff to concentrate more on their jobs instead of having to worry from one day to the next whether they will have any work or money to pay food and bills. Now, the other side of this, of course, Martin, is all to do with power relations, isn't it, between the employer and the employee. If someone who's on a zero-hours contract starts making a bit of a fuss about health and safety, say, for example, complaining, saying, well, I'm not actually being given enough time to look after a specific elderly person, maybe only given 10 minutes to do it when she feels she needs 20 minutes to do whatever care is necessary, she's going to find quite possibly that tomorrow she doesn't get a call.
Well, that's right. And if you remember, not long ago, Bristol City Council privatised its home help service. And of course, the effect of that is that people are doing the jobs that used to be done by the home helps for less money.
Yes, home care.
On these kind of contracts. And of course, what you really want with people who are doing home care is that they should be well paid, highly motivated, and they should build up a relationship with the people that they're dealing with. But of course, what they're doing is that, you know, the person who comes to care for you tomorrow isn't going to be the person who comes to care for you today. Now, ultimately, over time, of course, carers who are properly trained and doing the job properly, they will get the trust of the people they're working with, and they can give them a bath, even though they're elderly and they're a bit ashamed of their body and all the rest of it. But if you've got a new teenager, as it were, every day, that means that the job's just not being done properly.
This is one of the things that happens when you've got a large pool of unemployed people. But I mean, you're saying, oh, what we should be moving towards is the basic income. Actually, the complete opposite is happening, Martin. There's no basic income. And what's happening is people are having to go to food banks and they're having to try and sign on, when often that takes a very long time. We've just been told last week that it's going to be another week or so before people get any money in that way. And it's just more and more people chasing less and less money.
It makes me laugh, actually, the whole thing of not allowing people for the first week to claim any benefits. It's like, so they've gone from workers to shirkers in one go. Yesterday you had a job, today you haven't got a job, It's only 24 hours later, but you are a shirker now, and that's why we're not going to give you any money for 7 days, so get down to get the money off Wonga or whoever. It's quite clear. I mean, all of these kinds of social attacks are part of trying to mould the mind of the population, to try and reinforce the workhouse mentality, the whole Oliver Twist, can I have some more, sir, and all the rest of it. But actually, we need to break out of this and go towards a society which is based around constructive leisure and meaningful work for everybody.
But that isn't happening. I mean, we're going to end up here in Britain with the vast numbers of people who are unemployed and super low paid, people on these 0 hour contracts who are finding that they're not getting any work, actually out on the streets.
Well, yes, I mean, basically, if things carry on as they are, we've got a fairly miserable future ahead of us. But, of course, they aren't going to carry on as they are. If people look what's happening in the international stock markets, there's every possibility that before too very long, they are going to crash. And we won't be talking about 2.5 million unemployed. We'll be talking about 5 million unemployed.
Now, I noticed there was another big slide in the FTSE this week. What was all that about?
Well, that was about Portugal's the latest crack in the dam. But of course the previous week, when Bernanke suggested that he was going to cut off QE, there was immediately a kind of pre-warning heart attack in the financial markets, and he backtracked. So it's quite obvious they can't exit from QE. The Japanese have gone for full-on QE, but it's actually leading to a situation where their interest rate on their bonds is going up, or I can't remember, it's not working, because we're reaching the point where, pumping money into the system just isn't good enough anymore.
Well, there's two ways to get more people employed. One is to provide more jobs, and the other is to force those people to take less wages. And it seems that the latter is the one that's being pursued. Well, when are we going to see some kind of strategy that actually produces more well-paid, when I say well-paid, I mean just, basic income sort of level jobs, where you're working and you don't then have to go to a food bank?
Well, and also you don't have to be topped up with working families tax credit. So even people in work are still on benefits because they've got working families tax credit. We've got a situation where basically capitalism as currently organised cannot provide paying work to the majority of the population.
Well, I'm asking you, Martin, is how do we see our way through this?
Well, ultimately there will have to be a massive public investment in a different kind of economy, which won't completely get rid of the market, but the market will only be a minor, a relatively minor feature of it. As I've said before, I would see in 15 years' time, there will be a 70% public and third sector economy and a residual market economy. But that will be after a crash and the war. Crash and war first.
In the meantime, we're having to put up with something called the Work Programme, which is a private sector deal with Department for Work and Pensions money in order to try and help people to get work, which both you and I are on. I think both, Martin, aren't we? Although mine isn't going too well. How's yours going?
Well, I had an interview the other day and I didn't get the job, but the people I'm working with are not bad, but the problem is that there isn't any jobs and they can't magic them out of thin air.
Well, anyway, this was discussed by Gemma Doyle MP, and a question was asked to the Prime Minister on Wednesday this week, so let's have a listen to Gemma.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can the Prime Minister confirm that the latest work programme figures show that it is missing every single one of its minimum performance standards?
If the Honourable Lady is asking about the work programme, the fact is that it's actually got 312,000 people into work. 60% of the people going into the work programme are coming off benefits. And while the Unite Union and all the Unite members opposite might not want to hear this, and while it might not be part of Len McCluskey's script, the fact is this programme is twice as good as the Flexible New Deal.
One of the fascinating headlines to come out of that this week, Martin, was in the Telegraph of all places, saying that the work programme is worse than doing nothing. Just 1 in 20 people on sickness benefit who are on the work programme found any work. The target was 1 in 6. And that was before the work programme.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about this is that all of these work programme contracts were dished out 2 years ago, and the money, it's payment by results. So at the end of 2 years, the organisations that are implementing the programme will get their money, provided they've reached their targets. But I suspect most of them are not going to reach their targets, which means that essentially good organisations like Tomorrow's People, who are working with me, could be bankrupted by that. So this is, we're moving towards a situation where the whole thing is just going to implode. And I don't think the people who are trying to so-called reform the welfare state have any idea of the chaos that they're going
to cause. Isn't it a little bit like trying to stick a square peg in a round hole? Because you haven't actually got the jobs there that people need, and yet you're still trying to force them into them.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the unemployment rate has been relatively stable, but that's going to change. I suspect, as we hit financial turbulence, all of these kind of so-called green shoots are just going to disappear, like under the snow in April. And, we're going to be having to start asking ourselves serious questions about how are we going to organise society as we go forward. Don't forget, automation is getting rid of everything. In the 1970s, we used to talk about this as a problem that would be resolved by having more leisure. But when you've got a situation where a brain surgeon in China can put up a web page, which means that somebody untrained can just do their job for a fraction of the cost of the brain surgeon, and that's brain surgery, never mind anything else. Well, you're in a situation where automation is going to get rid of everybody, which should be a good thing. It should give us all leisure, except all the money from this and the profit from it goes to a few, and it's not distributed.
When I was last at my work program placement thing, I spoke to a lady there in the lift on the way down who'd been saying that that she's still on disability living allowance, and that she's being told that she has to apply for lots of work through this thing. I mean, it just seems to me crazy to try and get all these people to be applying. I mean, the figures speak for themselves. Improvement notices have been issued for 12 contracts, with providers facing losing their contract if they don't show significant changes. For 18 to 12 year olds, job seekers allowance claimants, just under a third found jobs in the second year of the programme, and the figure was 27% for 25 year olds. So both missed the minimum targets. For those on sickness benefits, like the lady talking about just now, 5.3% have found employment, compared to a target of 16.5%. So they're just missing all of the targets with these, Martin. And of course, those targets were used when first drawing up these contracts to see whether they're going to be value for money or not.
Exactly. And of course, if they don't meet the targets, all the organisations will then be bankrupted, having been spent on it, the organisations will be bankrupted, and then we'll be back to square one. And of course, this will probably happen as we go into the crash. But of course, people have got to start adopting the crash position.
They've got to start realising. If they had been, Martin, for the last 3 years, they would have been sitting with their heads between their knees, according to you. Still haven't had some crash.
Well, it's analogous to a car crash or anything else. It only hits the wall once, but when it does, you feel it.
And what's going to trigger it then? Because at the moment, you've got the big investment bankers making a fortune out of the way things are. So why should they be in any way interested?
That's why the bubble carries on inflating when it shouldn't. And of course, it's being given extra help by silly ideas like George Osborne's right to buy policy, where we're going to subsidise already relatively wealthy people to buy their own houses at taxpayer expense, so the house prices can rise a bit in the southeast of England. And we'll just walk straight onto the punch with this government. We're just going to walk straight onto the punch and lose our teeth.
Well, one of the reasons that the money isn't around to spend on things is because the government really isn't using very much its shareholding in some of the major nationalised banks. Have you got anything to say about that? When are they going to start using it and saying to them, actually ordering them to spend into the economy rather than sending all this quantitative easing money into the casino economy?
Well, what they're actually saying to them and they're pushing for is to privatise these banks. But that makes me laugh, because you can't privatise something. If people had a look at the books, they'd realise you can't privatise these banks because they're all bankrupt.
Are these the KPMG books?
All of them. All of the banks are bankrupt. They are basically trading where they shouldn't be trading, in fact. Ordinary companies, they wouldn't be allowed to trade.
I mean, surely the whole point is that the bank's books are dodgy. You know, if you looked at the books, they look okay, actually in reality, they're not.
They don't look okay. We've decided not to look at the books because we know what we'll find, which is that all of them are bankrupt, but we're pretending that they're not by pumping money into the system to keep them going. But of course, that is actually not just stupid, it also drags all the resources from the economy into speculative bubbles which don't actually add to investment. The level of investment is abysmal. It's just going nowhere.
Well,
investment is when you actually buy new plans and machinery, not buying a share certificate in a company. It's when the company actually buys in new flat plant machinery, trains workers. That's investment.
Okay.
And it's actually a physical thing, not a monetary thing.
Okay. Now, this whole subject of who is actually controlling these state-owned banks, whether it's themselves as independent banks or the Treasury, came up in Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. And Geoffrey Robinson asked a question.
Mr. Geoffrey Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is the Prime Minister aware of the rather disturbing commitment given yesterday by his Chancellor that he would continue to interfere and intervene in the affairs of the Royal Bank of Scotland on behalf of the taxpayer? Is he aware that his last intervention, the completely irresponsible ousting of Stephen Hester has cost the British taxpayer so far $4.5 billion in the loss of value in its shareholding? Will he, as First Lord of the Treasury, instruct his Chancellor to desist from any such interventions in the future?
What I would say to the Honourable Gentleman, who I know has great experience in lending money, is that... it's very important that the government stands up for the taxpayer and makes sure that Royal Bank of Scotland has the right strategy and the right leadership going ahead so that we get the money that was put by the last government into the banks, we get that money back.
We're not going to get it back, are we? This is the reality. Everybody's pretending that we're going to get this money back. So all the money we've put into the banks has been is not being included in the deficit because we're going to get that back, except we're not. So the deficit is far worse than is being presented. But of course, you can't cut your way out of a deficit. It's gradually coming grand. Even the stupidest people are beginning to realise that that's a non-starter. The more you cut, the bigger the deficit.
Now, we know the debt itself is over a trillion and it's going up fast. Why doesn't it matter if you're cutting the deficit by a little bit? These terms, it's really important to actually understand what they mean, isn't it?
Yeah. It is, but what you've got to realise...
Debt and deficit.
Well, the deficit is the year-on-year borrowing by the government. And, of course, you could... who are they borrowing from? Well, they're borrowing from the wealthy. But what they could do, of course, is actually borrow from themselves by reforming the currency. Positive money are talking about all of that, non-fractional reserve banking and so on. But the debt just carries on climbing. And, of course, what's becoming absolutely apparent is that austerity... See, it's a feedback loop. Austerity actually squeezes the economy, so people, whether they're unemployed or on low wages, haven't got money to spend, and therefore the economy gets smaller, and the ratio of the debt to the size of the economy continues to get bigger. And of course, that's what's happened in Portugal. The economy started to go down. As they cut, the economy goes down further, and then the debt gets bigger and bigger. And of course, you're then borrowing on the credit card to try and get through to the next week. And of course, at a certain point, that's not viable. And at some point, the elastic snaps, whether it's in Portugal or Syria, or it could be anywhere, really. Could be Britain. There could be a speculative attack on the pound. The pound is going down at the moment. The speculators just will run for the exit. And then there's 441 trillion worth of derivatives contracts out there. That's an enormous amount of money, and they could all go bad simultaneously. Now, how could that happen? Well, we've got ourselves into this situation by deregulating financial markets in the 1980s. Absolutely stupid idea. Shouldn't have done it. Bit late now.
Well, it's impossible, though, to put these sort of barriers up around Britain, isn't it? I mean, surely that's what you're suggesting.
That... No, but what Britain did with its allies in the United States is ram this financial deregulation down everybody's throats all over the world. And we said it was going to be fine, but it isn't fine. So it's not just that Britain can't manage its own affairs. Britain is telling everybody else what to do, even when it can't manage its own affairs. The City of London does dictate what goes on to the British government and to all sorts of governments. And it's a mess.
Well, we're joined by George Ferguson, who's managed to hot-foot it over in the heat from Ujima. I hope your staff are going to get their knuckles wrapped, George, when you tell us.
I don't know what.
Well, maybe was it? Are you sure it wasn't you that got the message wrong?
Well, when I left the office, they said Ujima Radio, Wilder Street. So that's all I knew.
Okay,
I don't know.
Let's not apportion blame.
I don't blame anybody.
You're here now.
I'm to blame ultimately now, for everything.
Everything in the city. Yeah. 350,000 people's blame all on one person. But anyway, George, we'll start off this week with this story which has come out in the last couple of weeks about this little bit of a row about your diary. What's going on with that? Because Peter Abraham says that when you don't turn up to something, people in the city council have a right to know why you haven't come there, and they want to know if something else is so important that George can't turn up at an event or a council meeting, a scrutiny committee, that kind of thing. We want to know why not.
I've always turned up to anything I've agreed to turn up to, so I don't know what that's all about. And I think that there's a little bit of mischief making going on. You know what some of these politicians are like, Tony, and so they're scoring points.
But isn't the easiest thing for you to just not agree to turn up to anything and then just turn up to things when you feel like it?
Well, that would be incredibly easy, but not really very efficient. So I definitely will. I keep a very good diary. I'm really nearly always on time, and I get quite irritated by people who are late. So it's a bit ironic that I'm made the cock up today and I'm late for you. But and I have a very, very full diary. I mean, I've got, you know, 10, 20, 30 minute slots at the most, unless it's something completely exceptional. And so I, you know, I do a hell of a lot. But what he was trying to get at is that I'm doing things that the Lord Mayor should be doing. Now, actually, the Lord Mayor and I have a really good working relationship. We share our diaries. I overlapped with him twice. And when we looked at the things I do, very few of the things that the Lord Mayor would have done. And the Lord Mayor's got a very busy diary too. So I see it as my purpose to get everywhere and to understand, you know, today I've come down from Manchester this morning, actually, so because I've been at a conference there. It was a Massive Attacks gig last night, which was tremendous. I've been to the Totterdown Mosque to talk to the community there about some of their concerns. And you know, maybe somebody would have said, oh well, a Lord Mayor should have done that, but in the end I've got to talk, and I enjoy engaging with every part of the Bristol community. It's that's the great thing about the job.
I think you know, what Peter's really getting at is he's not interested in your private engagements. He's saying that if you've got something that you're officially doing, it would be nice for people on the various committees on the city council to know George can't come because he's doing X.
Well, that's
official engagement.
No, but that's what usually said. So I think he's just creating a story out of nothing, and so I got a little bit peeved with him.
Okay.
But anyway, we're best friends now.
Okay, well, we'll see. He's coming on next week, so we'll see if he thinks the same. It would have been nice to have a pair of you all together, but maybe it would have been unbroadcastable. But anyway.
No.
Anyway, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you, the people of Bristol, what you make of George Ferguson's first 8 months or so as mayor of the city. So let's see what you made of it.
Oh, my God.
Bristol's Mayor George Ferguson has been in office for 8 months. Has he made a difference?
It depends on in what respect. He's closed the city centre every fourth Sunday, which some people see as beneficial for people who live in the centre, but it's certainly made a difference in terms of increasing traffic.
Yeah, I think everyone in Bristol is really happy right now, you know what I mean? St Paul's Carnival's this weekend, so we've still got that going on, which has kept spirits high as it wasn't on last year, and I think that got everyone on a bit of a downer. Everyone's really happy, and I'm really looking forward to this weekend, see everybody out, having a good time.
I think he's probably created quite a few waves with people, but we don't really have an awful lot to do with it. We live on the outskirts, so it's not affected us yet.
I'm not quite sure, to be honest, if he had or not.
I think in many ways he's made a difference, but I also think it's a huge shame that he won't allow the Bristol City Stadium move, and that may be for personal reasons, for his own business interests.
It does make a difference, yeah. I don't see people complaining anymore. Everybody's moving. It makes Bristol look good as well, tidy and clean, you know.
Were Bristolians right to reject party politics and elect an independent mayor?
From my perspective, no, I think that there was a party politician who would have been a better candidate, a better mayor for the city. He was a bit of an unknown, George Ferguson, to me, whereas party political candidates can draw on policies that that independents can't. Established policies, established manifestos.
Yeah, I think Bristol was right there. You know, I mean, it feels good to have somebody who's from Bristol representing Bristol. It brings people closer to the city, to know that the person who's in charge of their city lives in it and is here going out and working hard every day.
I think you have the right to vote with for who you want. I think if it's independent, how he perceives things has got an awful lot to do with the decisions he's making, and not necessarily for the good of the Bristolians.
Yeah, he has the right focus for Bristol, maybe not in all areas, but he's certainly making a difference on a lot of other issues. So I think he's appeared a lot on TV, he's been a lot in the newspapers. Even though I knock him at the start, you have to say with transport and with the green issues, he's doing really well.
Yeah, because now in Bristol start to have like his own money, Bristol Pound, and it's his people is pushing it forward.
He has been criticised for not turning up at civic events and not explaining his absence. Should his diary be published?
I think as long as he keeps the people in the know, you know what I mean, if he says it's down to private reasons, as long as he comes out and says that, then I think people will be understanding, because obviously the public don't really trust politicians at the moment due to the things that have happened in the last few years with the scandals and that. I think as long as he's honest as he can be, then people will trust him as much as they can.
I don't know that it should be published, but I think if he's been elected to do a job, then he should be, unless he has a very good reason, he should be turning up to these events, and he should be held accountable if he doesn't.
I think his diary should be private. The man has also got his own life, his own family and his own friends. Maybe he feels he can't attend every single appointment, so I think that's fine if he misses.
I think probably one of the strongest charges there, George, was this idea that you've got your own business interests, and are you abusing your position of mayor to actually further your own business interests?
Certainly not, Tony. I know that's a lovely little conspiracy. And that was said about the football ground. The irony is, the guy who is accusing me of blocking the Ashton Gate development is completely wrong, in that I was against the Sainsbury's development at Ashton Gate, but when I became mayor, I worked as closely as I could with Bristol City to make quite sure that we have an alternative scheme to the one that couldn't be built for legal reasons, nothing to do with me, about the Town and Village Green on Ashton Vale. And I think the City Football Club have got real about it. They realise that this is a real headbanger to go for the Ashton Vale scheme, so they've actually come up with a scheme that does better for them, it makes more economic sense, it doesn't involve Sainsbury's, and I'm doing everything I can to help them with that scheme, because that is vitally important for this city. As I said, I've just come back from Manchester. Manchester's economy is hugely boosted by the success of their football teams. Ours has gone the other direction. We've got to try and do everything we can to reverse that.
I mean, what do you think is going to happen there? Because a lot of people are looking at the Ashton Vale scheme and saying, well, what are they wanting to do? Just buy a bit of cheap land, get the planning permission to build a massive stadium, which is going to boost their finances, because they're in a financial black hole right now.
Yeah, but they can't do that now, because there are new rules.
So what do you think
new rules now?
What is going to happen?
So what will happen is there will be an incremental redevelopment of the Ashton Gate site. It will provide a sports museum, it will provide exhibition and conference space, it will provide much, much better viewing, it will embrace rugby as well, and it will be a huge benefit to the whole of Bristol, those who follow Bristol rugby and Bristol City. And Bristol Rovers, of course, are doing their own, which is a really good one as
well. George, will it help City start winning?
Well, you need good players, don't you? So it's the general rule is that people with better stadia have attracted better players, and so I think it's part of it, but there's no silver bullet.
Okay. Martin, what are your thoughts about these property deals? Because a lot of these football clubs nowadays, when they see themselves in a difficult situation financially, are concentrating on trying to do financial deals rather than actually just focusing on what they're doing on the pitch.
Well, George mentioned their Manchester's football teams. Of course, Manchester United is probably the most successful football team in the world financially, certainly. But of course, because they were bought in a leveraged buyout by a multi-billionaire, I've forgotten the chap's name, they're paying off debts, and they're struggling even though they're so successful. And I think this is what's happened with the Premier League in general. Is you know, it's become a plaything for multi-billionaires, and you know, I hope that City and Rovers, if they do upgrade, don't lose their roots in the community and being part of the community of Bristol, because that's part of the problem with what's happened with the Major League Football.
Absolutely.
One of the big things that changed since you've become mayor, George, is also the introduction of the Police and Crime Commissioners, and obviously that's going to be a little bit of a difficult relationship with the chief constables used to running the shop pretty much alongside the old police committees, and now a Police and Crime Commissioner. Now, just on the other side of the Severn, there's been a bit of a battle over the last few weeks with the Police and Crime Commissioner reading out a document to the chief constable over in Gwent, and basically sacking her. And this was in the House of Commons this week at the Home Affairs Select Committee that had a look at that. So before we discuss what's going on in Avon and Somerset and how it's going, let's have a look a little bit, because we often don't do that, do we, here in Bristol? We don't listen to the Welsh radio much, apart from when Five Live is just doing tennis all the time. We might listen to Radio Wales occasionally then, at least I do. But let's have a little glance across to Newport now to see what's been going on with the Police and Crime Commissioner and the Chief Constable over there.
I felt that the tone of the document and how he delivered it was both menacing and bullying.
And was it just the two of you?
Just the two. And I felt, actually, from the tone of the note, that it was a clear threat. Retire or resign, or actually, horrible words, I will humiliate and dismiss you. But again, that's what rang in my head.
He actually said those...
Yes, that was the that's what is in the 23rd of May document.
I think the Commission has this document.
As he was reading that to me, because remember I had no copy, it's a bit like going to the doctors to hear bad news, isn't it? You recall key parts of it. And certainly I felt that it was a clear threat, retire or resign, or I will humiliate and dismiss you.
She said her initial response had been to fight it.
But having taken legal advice, I found that the way that the government had drafted the legislation in the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Gap,
yes,
apparently gave the PCCs unfettered powers to appoint, suspend and remove chief constables.
The main reason why I decided to take the action I did was that the chief constable, from day one, now looking back, just did not accept the role of the Police and Crime Commissioner.
What I find difficult to understand, unless she actually said to you, I don't like your position, that this legislation should never have been introduced in the first place, perfect, understandable view shared by a lot of people, but unless she said that, which I would have thought is unlikely, how do you know? How can you read her mind?
Perhaps I can give you one or two examples, brief, very brief. One of my statutory duties is the estate strategy, buildings, police stations and the like. And Chief Constable and I had many discussions around how police stations and front offices had been closed in Gwent. And her response to that was that it was nothing to do with me. And yet clearly under the legislation it is.
That was the Police and Crime Commissioner over in Gwent and Newport. That's Ian Johnson there. And before you heard the former, who's now resigned and retired, Carmel Napier, former Chief Constable. George, how do you think things are going over here? Because this is a big, big slice of the public budget does go into policing. And this is quite a new way of running things, having these kind of double-headed thing with the Police and Crime Commissioner on the one hand and the Chief Constable on the other.
Well, we had a rocky start here, actually, with Colin Port, who was the Chief Constable, and the Police and Crime Commissioner, Sue Mount Stevens, and that was a very public tiff, really, between them. Colin's now gone, and we now have Nick Gurney, who's the new... Nick Gargan, who's the new Chief Constable, who is... No, Nick Gurney's another guy. Nick and Sue seem to have a very good working relationship. I think it promises a lot of good for the future. I think he's speaking a lot of sense. He's been criticised for being a bit soft on small crime, but I think he is somebody who's very pragmatic, and that those two will work really well together, and all three of us, actually. I mean, we find that we are seeing eye to eye on some major social and legal issues.
Well, it's all very well this side of the Severn, but on the other side it's not too good. Of course, Newport was one of the places in the country where not a single person actually turned out to vote, Martin, for the Police and Crime Commissioner in that election. One of the voting centres, not a single person all day turned out to actually vote.
I think the problem with this is that they haven't really got a mandate. I mean, there's arguments about whether mayors have got a proper mandate in terms of the turnout and so on, but that's another story. But when you've got sort of the 14% turnout, and policing really, I mean, the professional police officer has been saying at every level, this is a professional job. It's not the sort of thing that people can walk in and amateurise at the top. Hopefully, we'll try and make sense of the mess. I'm sure that the professional police officers want to make it work because they've got to. But on the other hand, their advice all along was that this was going to create problems, and they were right, of course.
Yeah.
George, going back to your election, I got the first bit of election literature saying vote for George through my door around about, I think, probably 6-7 months before the actual election itself.
I launched my election on the 4th of July, Independence Day. And so just the anniversary just passed of the launch of my election. Yeah, it was a long election campaign, but I felt, and I'd announced that I would stand if the referendum came out in favour of having a mayor, even before the referendum.
But so that was before the official, this is the point, the official start of campaigning.
Absolutely. And so
you were spending money before that.
Yes,
and so, of course, lots of the parties looked at you afterwards and said, well, that's cheating. Because what you've done is you've been spending money on your campaign before anyone else has even started, and before the statutory...
parties say that. That's what they do. But the parties are much more clumsy in the way they do things. They've got to go through loads of procedures, which means that they weren't able to declare a candidate as early as I was. But I was very aware that it's a big... I mean, it was a remarkable...
So how much did you actually spend on your campaign then?
Well, during the actual election itself...
Before as well.
Probably in excess of 40,000. It was probably about 45. I raised about 30 and I spent about 15 of my own, and that is a lot of money. But I knew that if you had to beat these huge national party structures with all their advantages, they've got all the canvassing returns from previous elections, they've got huge memberships, or some have, they're dwindling, they've got delivery resources, they've got everything. And they've got their own logos that are recognisable. They've got...
It doesn't cost you that much to do a logo.
No, it does, funnily enough.
Does it really?
Because you have to register as a party to be able to use one. So there are loads of things militating against the independent. So it was a surprise. And I've just been to the local government association conference, the big annual conference in Manchester, and people were staggered that... it had happened in Bristol. And I think a lot of people are looking to Bristol. I mean,
well, they are.
Loads of people are looking to Bristol.
One of the main reasons we were given for voting for a mayor in the referendum about a mayor was that we would have somebody, you, who would have the ear of the Prime Minister, able to sort of nip down to Downing Street, have a chat with Dave, get everything sorted out.
Every other day.
What's the actual reality, though, George?
The reality is I do have the ear of all the secretaries of state. It's not, you know, I don't mean a sort of cosy way, but I do have access to government in a way that most leaders don't. I think Joe Anderson, who's the mayor of Liverpool, I was with day before yesterday, he also finds that he gets good access. I think
I get
better access as an independent because I'm not seen as being making a party point when I...
They pick up the mobile when you phone them, is that what it means?
Some do.
Yeah? What about the Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling? Because at the moment there's a tremendous amount of cuts going on in legal aid. I mean, I would imagine, you know, as a Liberal, at least in the past anyway, a Liberal Democrat, you'd be quite concerned about the fact that legal aid was being taken away from some of the most vulnerable in our society. So have you had a chat with Chris?
Of course I haven't, actually, no, but of course I'm concerned about that. I think that it's a... they use such clumsy tools to deal with these things. I think they need to be much more... much more sensitive to special cases, and people just fall the wrong side of the line with legal aid, and it's a cruel judgment sometimes.
Martin, what about your thoughts on legal aid? We're going to be discussing it with a couple of solicitors in the second hour, but I mean, it does seem actually really quite dangerous to be taking away legal aid from people who are the most vulnerable right across our society, especially when people are being put on these 0 hours contracts, all sorts of real difficulties in actually just literally making ends meet from day to day, and suddenly you're told, oh well, the legal aid it's being taken out from underneath you.
Yes, well, of course. I mean, I think there's a general progressive view on this, and the lawyers, you know, know how to defend their corner. I mean, they've made the government back down on the whole idea of people not being able to choose their own lawyers. So, in other words, that there's some give there. And, you know, what we really need is a change of heart in Westminster about a lot of things, and I hope George, in his own non-confrontational way, is doing his best to try and persuade these people to get sensible about stuff.
Well, can I say one really useful vehicle is that I'm on the core cities cabinet. There are eight of us. We're the leaders of the eight principal cities in England, outside London. And we are, you know, we just had a meeting with Ed Miliband and some of the shadow ministers, and we do so with the principal ministers as well, the government ministers. And more we are feeding in sensible policy making. And I think that certainly there is the hope that policy making in the future will be more intelligent, because it takes account of what happens on the ground.
Just forget the opposition for a minute. What about the Prime Minister? What about the Cabinet? Can you give us anything that you have bent the ear of the Cabinet and got results from?
Yes, we are making, in terms of the city deal that we're doing for the wider area, including the three surrounding authorities, we've done well out of that. We're just about to sign that off.
What are we getting out of it? What's Bristol getting out of it?
Well, Bristol will be getting the Greater Bristol area. The city region will be getting £400 million worth of transport investment, for instance. We are getting we're making huge steps. We're getting much more. Although I think much more can be done in terms of devolving power and money, we are getting much more than we would have done before.
Well, with £400,000, maybe we could start up the old Bristol Omnibus company. £400 million.
Did I say 400,000?
Okay, well, that's
400 million.
So where's that going then?
That's going into the metro systems, into rail, and
is it going into First Group, First Group's pockets to help bail out their debts?
No, that is a private company. No, this is investment in infrastructure, in our infrastructure. Now, First may be one of the suppliers, but they certainly, in terms of, you know, they may be bidding for the metro bus, they may be bidding for the metro rail. They are the dominant provider in this area, but the certainly no infrastructure money goes to them. They may benefit from the fares in the future, and I want those to be lower.
What about the metro rail, metro bus then? Give us an idea. How long's the programme, and when's it going to be here?
Well, the programme's about 7 years. We're talking about 2020 and beyond, actually. So, but the bulk of it's in the seven years or so. It's things like the Portishead line, proper park and ride services with fast buses. I want those to be electric or very, very least hybrid. There'll be smart city car type public transport rather than the fumy diesel, slightly noisy, old-fashioned public transport that we have at the moment.
That's a long time to wait, though. Any light at the end of the tunnel, a little bit more up-to-date, George?
No, we're kicking some of that off now, so that will be starting next year, you know, in terms of the actual physical on-the-ground investment.
I think for people commuting, using public transport, particularly in the city, they really want to know what concrete is there going to be in the next couple of years that's really going to change.
Well, for instance, the metro bus schemes will be coming in over the next 2 or 3 years.
Okay. One of the things,
and the better park and ride, and we're looking for more park and ride to the north of the city. Those have to be done as partnerships with our surrounding authorities.
It would be a bit of a no-brainer, wouldn't it, to have one up at the interchange of the M32 and the M4, one up there? I mean, that seems to be the obvious place.
You are right. Anyway, we're pretty advanced in those conversations.
Well, let's hope so. Yeah. One of the things we've been discussing in here and being quite critical about the council for, I'm not sure to what extent you're involved, is this advisor that your office told us are up there helping with the budget, or at least were before it was passed. This is this guy, Matthew Payne from KPMG. Now, I mean, there have to be questions raised, George, about the appropriateness of having a volunteer from KPMG actually helping you to go through the council budget and make decisions about taxpayers' money when KPMG are themselves involved in this inquiry from the Competition Commission, actually looking into them being behind price fixing with the other big four accountancy firms also, not least of which is the fact that KPMG were one of the companies that signed off the accounts of the banks in the run-up to the 2008 crisis, which were then proven to be basically false accounting going on, where they're saying that these were healthy banks, and Gordon Brown found out that they weren't at all healthy, that they hadn't been doing their job properly as auditors. So why have we got a volunteer, or did we have a volunteer, Matt Payne, helping you organise the budget here?
Well, he was one of a lot of people who and his company who volunteered to help because we got an elected mayor, because they saw that things were going to be done differently, because they were energised by what was happening to Bristol, and that has been a huge benefit. So it's not just KPMG, it's individuals too who have absolutely nothing to gain from it. KPMG know perfectly well that if they're to do any paid work for the city, they have to tender alongside anybody else. To be honest, I don't know enough about what you've just been talking about price fixing, or whether that's true or not, but I will certainly go back and have a question that. But I've got absolutely no doubt about Matt Payne's veracity and decency. He's been one of the very useful people in terms of helping me look deeper into the accounting in the city, and I think that's only good. It's shining a light on what's happening. I don't think there's anything dodgy going on, but I do think sometimes you need fresh eyes and people with the ability, and the fact of life is that some of those people with ability lies in those sort of firms.
Well, the Competition Commission haven't delivered their final report on the possible price fixing by these big four accountancy firms, but it certainly does look dodgy, doesn't it, George, that the 200 top FTSE companies are all audited by these four companies, and also that they've been organising contracts with those companies they're auditing, saying that if you want any other services, you have to use one of the other big four companies. Now, this is really anti-competitive. It shuts out the mid-range financial services firms as well.
How do you actually
go about choosing which volunteers you allow into your little inner circle when you're going through the budget?
Well, I've been pragmatic about it, but I think it's a very good point that I hate this domination by global practices and global companies. I think you know me well enough is that I like as local as you can get. So I think it's there are some good independents in that field, but a bit like the big four supermarkets, the big four consultancies seem to dominate the field, and we've got to see how we can start running
but
that.
But in
back.
A way, having him in there is an endorsement of that.
It might be seen like that. Yeah, I can understand it might be seen like that. It certainly wasn't in my mind, but I'll take your point.
Thanks.
And I'm always ready to learn and be criticised.
Well, I've invited Matt to come in here, but of course I get no reply at all.
Right.
For him to explain, what is his expertise.
Well, all I can say is, an individual, he's been unbelievably helpful, and that is, the citizens of Bristol have benefited from it.
Okay.
I couldn't have cut out the money I've cut out with some of the help, without some of the help I've got, and maintain services at the level I have if I hadn't got some of that external advice.
What about the bigger macroeconomic picture, though, George? I mean, we're looking at a situation where the debt, and Martin and I were talking about this before you arrived, is going up at an incredible rate. The deficit is being slightly tweaked, but it really, all it is, it's just a slight alteration in the angle of the ski slope upwards, actually, in this case, of debt. And there's really nothing being done. It looks to me,
you're talking about the national debt.
The national debt, yeah. That this is never going to be paid back, this money, and we're just, all you and the council are now doing is simply having to look at what you're going to cut next. There's very little opportunity for you to be proactive and say, this is what the council wants to build, this is what the council wants to do. For example, social housing.
Well, can I just say, I'm going through that absolute, just that exercise. This is what the council wants to do, build social housing. Exactly that sort of thing. I'm creating a three-year budget, a three-year financial plan. It, of course, it'd be budgeted year by year. And it's a very different way of it being done. We're looking from base at the things that, A, that we have to do statutorily, the things that we're stuck in contracts with that would cost too much to extract from, and I think one or two of those are not that satisfactory.
Is May Gurney, the waste contract, one of those?
It may be. it may be. And the things that, or they may be stuck in it, and it actually might be, rather than us being stuck.
Mutually beneficial to part company, possibly.
But we'll one see about that. You know, you've got to know that you're going to get a better deal from somebody else. And then there are the things that are non-statutory that I believe, or the city believes, are desirable to happen for a healthy city. So we're looking fundamentally at building up a budget and then trying to make it match what we've got.
Residence parking. We left this till last. Because I think the biggest, probably the most obvious complaint about the way you've been dealing with this, George, is that you're trying to force parts of the city that have absolutely no parking problem down the same road as places like St Paul's, which are used as a giant great car park for people who are using the city during the day, and they're parking there. Obviously there's a problem of some sort in St Paul's, and also of course there are some areas of the city that are able to pay these parking charges and others that aren't, but you're trying to treat it as one homogenous unit, which
actually
it isn't.
I think people have tried to paint, I've seen the posters on me with my face and a bay written underneath.
Oh, that's right, yes. That's the Bristolian, isn't it? Bristol version of Private Eye.
I've been retweeting them because I'm amused by them, but I absolutely don't believe they represent the truth.
So what are you doing?
Because I have actually been extremely involved with communities about it. I've said that I'm carrying out a proper consultation process, and when I say consultation, I mean consultation. I don't mean PR.
So why is it not on the council?
PR has been terrible.
Why is it not on the council website? This is someone that pointed this out in the Evening Post. It may be now, but it certainly wasn't at the beginning of the week. There wasn't the proper programme of where the public meetings are taking place, for example, on the council website.
We haven't started the formal consultation process yet. We're only just starting it. At the moment, we're in the informal stage for most of the schemes. I mean, we're looking at 10 areas now instead of 18, in addition to the three or four that already exist, including the central parking zone. And we are adjusting to local conditions, we're adjusting to special conditions. I said that I would re-look at the boundary, and I have, and I've, you know, and that was seen as a U-turn. It wasn't a U-turn, it was saying what I would do is that I'm absolutely sure of the principle, which is part of an overall transport strategy. You've got to increase demand for public transport, and where you go to places that have not carried this out, you don't get that extra demand.
What about cheap? What about just cheap fares and buses that turn up on time?
Well, you've got to do that as well. And I absolutely agree that our fare's too high. I mean, I've had some useful wins with them. We'll see what comes out of this consultation. We've got, there have been some special things that have happened, but for special situations where we've got young people, half-price fares, if they joined joined the station in the centre, the station youth centre, we've got £5 family fares on my special Sundays, which have been a huge success, and £8 family fare, which is,
this is certainly chipping away to a certain extent, but I mean,
but we've got to do much more fundamental.
What would be wonderful for you, wonderful for you, George, is you had a lot more money to play with, and you didn't have to spend most of your time chopping the budget. Martin, is there anything advice you've got for George?
Absolutely.
Well, I think if you look at the standard spending assessment, I think Liverpool is losing some of the most per head, and Dorset is getting a slight increase.
Yeah.
And that's totally unfair.
Shocking,
You represent an urban area, and you're in alliance, hopefully, with all the others representing the urban areas.
Absolutely. Why should
Liverpool take the hit for the City of London's failures? It's just not on, really, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, are we ever going to get
total
to...
total agreement, and...
are we going to get to grip with the city? Because they're the people we need to get into line, surely.
Yeah, well, that's what's so strong about the Core Cities Group. We are 8 leaders of the engine house of the UK.
Well,
we represent 25% of the economy.
You have to get on the phone to George Osborne on his mobile number. Have you got his mobile number, George?
I haven't got George's, but I have. I was with Eric Pickles yesterday, so I get
on the way there. Thanks very much, George. We've got to go to the news now. Murdoch's news at 6. That was Bristol's Mayor George Ferguson. Join us after the news.
Community radio station for Bristol. Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Labour leader's involved in a public row with his party's biggest union backer, Ed Miliband, demanding the General Secretary of Unite...